This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, a program sponsored in part by the Lions Club of Rutland, and thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next half hour, we will be bringing you news from the July 23rd edition of The Landmark. This is Mo Ryan. First up today, we have Paxton Voters Face Summer Decision on Override by Ken Cleveland. Another town election is coming up for the Paxton voters, with the state primary and general elections to follow this fall. The August 10th town election will feature a single question, a $386,289 Proposition 2.5 override. After a spring override failed, the town budget was trimmed, but a town meeting effort to add back some of the cuts resulted in a smaller override being proposed. The funds in the $386,289 override would be added back to various line items. The override would add $141,000 to general government line items, $131,163 to public safety spending, $57,750 to public works line items, $2,106 to human services, and $4,000 to the library. In addition, $25,000 would be returned to both the ambulance receipts and certified overlay, covering the $50,000 that was spent to help them fund the budget when the initial override failed. The election will be held from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. at the Paxton Center School. There are other ways to vote. There's no general in-person early voting, but those who qualify for absentee voting can vote in person early. Anyone can vote early by mail. For those who have not already requested to vote by mail this year, the last day to request a vote by mail ballot for the special town election is August 3rd. The completed ballots must be received, not postmarked, by 8 p.m. August 10th to be counted. Anyone who already submitted a vote-by-mail application for, quote, all elections this year, need not submit a new application. Voters can apply online or submit a paper application. For those who wish to vote but have not registered, the last day to do so is July 31st. A YouTube recording of the June 22nd special town meeting details the override and budget discussion. At that meeting, voters passed the first of two needed approvals. A breakdown of the line items adjustments is on the town website. Two voter information sessions have been slated with town administrator Robert Birkbeck and select board member providing information. They are scheduled for 3 p.m. Wednesday, July 22nd, at the Richards Memorial Library, with the select board member Jeff Wenzel co-hosting, and at 10 a.m. Wednesday, August 5th, at the Council on Aging, with select board member Steve Robesco co-hosting. Next up, The Pan Mass is Personal for Van Giessen by Danielle Ray. Sterling, town resident Ben Van Giessen will be participating in the upcoming Pan Mass Challenge next month, and his reasons for doing so are deeply personal. After his wife Lindsay was diagnosed with stage 3 lymphoma on March 2020, she received treatment at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, the beneficiary of the annual bicycle fundraiser. Fortunately, she has been cancer-free since September 2020, thanks to the exemplary care she received at Dana-Farber. But the couple has also had a number of friends and family affected by cancer, which was another motivator for Ben to join the Pan Mass Challenge, set for August 1st and 2nd this year. Quote, that combined with the start being moved this year to College of the Holy Cross, where I'm employed, made it seem like a no-brainer, Ben said. I've been trying to ride seriously since I turned 40 and wanted to take care of myself more. This just seemed like a great combination of interests and a way to give back. Ben grew up in Rhode Island, attended Stonehill College in Easton for his undergraduate degree. He and Lindsay have been married for 11 years, lived in Sterling since 2014, and have three kids, aged 9, 7, and 2. Ben said he has been aiming to train 4 to 6 days a week for the upcoming bike race, depending on the week and what the family has going on. Quote, I work a full-time job and have younger children, so finding a balance can be a challenge. But I certainly give a massive amount of credit to my wife for helping me find the time, he said. When asked what he is looking forward to about being part of the Pan-Mass Challenge, he said that as this is his first year doing it, he does not know exactly what to expect, but is excited to be a part of it. Quote, all I've heard are great things about the event, so I'm really looking forward to it, Ben said. The challenge of the ride, the camaraderie, cruising along different parts of Massachusetts I've never ridden through on a bike before, seems like a great time. He is doing one day of the race, 100 miles from Holy Cross in Worcester to Bourne on Cape Cod. Quote, maybe next year I'll try the second day, which continues on to Provincetown after an overnight stay at the Mass Maritime Academy in Bourne, Ben said. His family will be cheering him on along the route, which will be a welcome sight. Quote, there are areas they will be able to stop and cheer, and I would expect to see them at the finishing area too, especially since they are my ride home, he quipped. Ben is about $600 shy of his $4,000 fundraising goal, and he is grateful for all of the donations he has received from those who have visited his profile online, which also includes some information about himself. The website is profile.pmc.org/PMC/BV0065. Quote, I really appreciate everyone's generosity so far, and that I'm very close to my goal thanks to all the contributions, he said. 100% of the money raised goes directly to research, so I know their donations are going to great work. Quote, whether people have been able to give large or small amounts doesn't matter to me. Just knowing they believe in the idea and are supporting me is what really matters. Good luck to Ben on his long bike ride. Next up, we have Wachusett Outdoor Window. Nature Tends Not to Deceive by Ted Purcell, community correspondent. I heard a lot of folks begin the month saying, I can't believe it's July already. My heart tended to agree, but my head saw the typical signs. Bird song decreasing, lawns burning out, veggie gardens starting to produce, fueled by the hot muggies, purple, white, and yellow meadow flowers in full bloom, and much to my disdain, sunsets getting earlier. The smoke from wildfires in central Canada have caused some crazy orangish, pinkish, and reddish skies, even obscuring the views of Venus, which has been prominent in the western sky after sunset and will be for several more weeks. The signs of summer are about where they should be, so despite the fact that we feel or fear we are seeing the season blitz by, things are about the way they should be. Regularly, I write about citizen science efforts which I participate, such as the Hawk Watch, the Breeding Bird Census, or the July Butterfly Count. Often, I am asked questions or see questions posted online such as, are you seeing more Baltimore Orioles this year? Or is it my imagination? Or are there fewer pollinators such as butterflies around this year? Or boy, it's been really windy or really rainy this season. Observations such as these are called anecdotal evidence. In and of themselves, they don't mean all that much, or they can be explained by where someone is located or a change, such as cutting down a bunch of trees, or a field that has grown into woods, or coincidence. Often, these observations or the world around us become the ideas for things that should be researched. They become hypotheses to use the scientific method. These are the types of things that scientists might study. Oftentimes, those scientists need help, because the scope of the data that they need is just so huge. That is where citizen science can come in and be useful. Long-range data collected by organizations such as Eastern Massachusetts Hawk Watch, the North American Butterfly Association, or more locally, the Furbush Bird Club or the Ware River Nature Club. It's been a dry summer. It's been a cold winter. It's been a wet spring. Our frequent conversation starters and are generally based on anecdotal observations. Despite some recent rain events, we are still well below the average for rain and meet the criteria for moderate drought. This is affecting the natural landscapes as well as lawns and gardens. I know I have been watching my gardens that I can watch regularly. Most local bodies of water are below average. Several people have recently mentioned that they are seeing fewer pollinators, insects such as bees and butterflies, and fewer frogs, especially pickerel frogs, which are often found outside of ponds in longer wet grassy areas. These are anecdotal observations, but could be long-term consequences of drought. Daylight savings time, or the bill to quote, end it, is making an annual appearance. The headlines sounded more optimistic than years past, so here is what I have been able to learn. A bill has passed the U.S. Congress that would end the changing of the clocks, leaving the federal time as daylight savings, what we have from March until November. But states could opt out if they pass their own legislation. The bill is known as the Sunshine Protection Act, and President Trump backs it and has for years. The Senate has been where this has failed in the past, so do not start celebrating yet. Each year, here in Massachusetts, legislation to end it is proposed and does not get passed. There are strong arguments for and against it, and of course, lots of opinions. Yours truly is on record in numerous editions of this column as for later sunsets. Many here in Massachusetts fear kids will be adversely affected by going to school in the dark, which many high schoolers already do. Many traffic studies show fewer automobile accidents happen when the evening commute home is not in the dark. I have noticed in our Florida travels that students there go to school in the dark most of the year. How can this be? Time zones are many hundreds of miles wide. Sunrise in Boston is an hour earlier than sunrise in Detroit, Michigan. Florida is well west of Massachusetts and thus has a later sunrise and sunsets. My guess is that the proposal stalls out in the Senate yet again. Hope to have an update later in the year. Last month, I mentioned the El Nino weather climate pattern predicted to establish itself in the Pacific Ocean. It has, and there is some evidence it is a strong one. Remember the super El Nino term from last month? So far, the hurricane season has been quiet, which often goes along with El Nino, but the larger impact is usually not realized until winter. Sometimes El Nino means cooler and wetter winter weather down south, including Florida, and for us wetter, but often more rainy than snowy, as it puts us on the edge of the jet stream winds. For my fishing buddies and me, it has been a windy spring and an early summer. Or perhaps the days we are able to fish, it just happens to be windy. My wife regularly asks me, "Will the weather be good for fishing?" And she means sunny and warm. For fishing, good weather means not too windy, sun, clouds, and rain are not as much of a concern as the wind. Wind affects the ability to cast, one's ability to be comfortable and or safe in a boat, or keep the boat where you need it. There seems to be some scientific evidence that with climate change, we will see changes in numerous patterns, including wind patterns. We often target the south side of Cape Cod for our fishing, and the typical summer wind pattern there is for moderate to strong southwest winds in the afternoon. Those make for comfortable temps in the summer that attract people to the beaches. It also makes boating in Nantucket Sound very challenging, as those winds build the seas and many afternoons can be uncomfortable on a smaller boat. Our son has been able to take advantage of some nice days or go early in the morning and has been rewarded with some nice catches of striped bass and black sea bass. Remember his friends from the May article whose kids had the fishing at Rutland State Park? He got them and their mom on the salt water for the first time a couple of weeks ago, and they had a blast. I'm told Oakley, the youngest sister of the trio, had the hot rod for the day, and all three kids demolished their fillets for dinner. Here's the featured outdoor opinion. This one is no secret. Mount Wachusett, a.k.a. Mount Wachusett State Reservation, a.k.a. The Mountain, it's a ski resort by winter, hawkwatch site by fall, and year-round hiking destination. Being a wheelchair user, the nature of Mount Wachusett would not be user-friendly but for the drive-up feature from June through October. People walk it, jog it, bike it, or drive it, many bringing their dogs. One fellow even walks his cat Wild Thing up it regularly. It has numerous well-maintained hiking trails, a drivable road, and an excellent tower at the top affording great views in all directions. One can see Worcester, Boston, Wachusett Reservoir, Mount Monadnock, and even Mount Washington under the right conditions. Regulars hike it daily, some for sunrise, some for sunset, some at night. It is often a date spot. It is maintained by Mass DCR as a park and a portion rented to the Crowley family, who operate Mount Wachusett Ski Area. The lifts are even operated in the summer and fall for people to get the view. It is a great nature draw, and it offers varying habitats, some of which cannot be found in many other places, and is a great exercise opportunity. People can say, "I climbed a mountain." There are some areas of old-growth forest in the mountain. This is forest that has never been cleared by humans. It looks the same as it did when the first humans came to North America, whether we are talking about those from thousands of years ago who formed the basis of the Native American population, or those from Europe and other areas in the past few centuries. Most of the forest here in New England was at one time cleared for farming and is new growth, even if it is 100 or more years old. At the summit of Mount Wachusett, there are plants, including grasses, that grow in few other places. Trails up the mountain range from fairly gentle walks in the woods to steep, rocky terrains. One trail even has two areas of bog habitat. Altitude can mimic latitude, huh? If you drive north from the Wachusett area through New Hampshire or Maine, traveling several hundreds of miles, you can see changing habitat types. Trees and other species that are adapted to colder climate types inhabit these areas as you get farther and from the equator and closer to the pole, and you start to see the difference. Shorter growing season and cooler temps favor more coniferous pines and spruces trees and different birds, insects, and mammal species. You begin to see more bog habitat, which is something Wachu has to offer. This is the effect of a change in latitude, aka the distance from the equator. If you go up in altitude, height above sea level, such as climbing Mount Wachusett, you can see similar changes as the temps are cooler and the growing season is shorter. You can also see the impact of winds, which are greater at altitude and cause the trees to be shorter and more compact. Even though Wachusett is a fairly modest-sized mountain, 2,005 feet above sea level, you can see this effect. Try climbing one of the 4,000 footers in New Hampshire, and you see the effect with greater ease. There has been more than one yucky hot day in July or August where I have driven to the summit of Mount Wachusett just to cool off. Conversely, head up some days in September or October for the hawk watch, leaving comfortable temps at the base, and you'll need a hat and gloves and a winter coat at the summit. Scott Wallstrom, a former teaching colleague and frequent partner in crime for Bird Nerds and other outdoor operations, made hiking Mount Wachusett part of his physical fitness routine the better part of 10 years ago. Being a science teacher and an outdoor enthusiast, he quickly recognized some of these differences. I began getting pictures with captions such as, "What bird is this?" or, "I hear the bird singing in the woods on the mountain, but never near my house." He has turned this into a personal study that will generate some citizen scientific data. One of the bird species he inquired about was the dark-eyed junco. This species was common nesting species in the Worcester County until several decades ago, and is a fixture at bird feeders here in the winter. We are there south. As things have gotten warmer, this species has pretty much given up on Worcester County for nesting and nests further north or higher up, such as Mount Greylock. It turns out Mount Wachusett is cool enough that it has become the last stronghold for nesting in our area. The butterfly species called a harvester can only be found up in the mountains here in central Mass. Red squirrels outnumber gray squirrels, a characteristic of the White Mountains in New Hampshire. For two spring bird migration seasons now, Scott has been recording a catalog and cataloging bird song using the Merlin app as he hikes the mountain. He has data that shows how certain species of birds stratify as you go up in elevation, meaning at certain heights you will see different species. For the recent butterfly count, Scott and his wife Justine, my wife Cindy, and I spent 4 hours and had great observations. Even the butterflies stratify. Near the summit, we saw American lady butterflies, and lower down, clouds of great spangled fritillary butterflies. Coming up, as June turns to August, I cannot help but mention two things I mention every summer column. First is the change from bird song to bug song. Some birds are still singing, especially robins and cardinals, but many vocal nesters have quieted down, focusing on rearing their young. The sunrise morning chorus of birds is much diminished. In its place, crickets, cicadas, tree crickets, and katydids will take their place. This will rise to a crescendo for much of August and September. The other is meteors, aka shooting stars. I see my best meteors in August, often before sunrise, as I head out fishing, but often after it gets dark, maybe sitting around a fire making s'mores, try to decide if I need a s'more. August features the annual Perseid meteor shower. It peaks this year the nights of August 11th and 12th, and 12th and 13th, but can create gorgeous shooting stars from early August into early September. These are the best, in my humble opinion, starting on one side of the sky and streaking all the way across to the other. On peak nights, under correct conditions, low light and cloud-free, there's the potential to see hundreds of them. The Hawk Watch at the summit of Wachusett will begin the last weekend of August. Consider coming up to check it out. Fall bird migration starts way before September 21st. Some Arctic tundra nesting species have already started moving down, and young of the year birds will start to fill our yards, woods, and fields. Blueberries are ripening locally. The Ware River Nature Club, which hosts regular programs throughout the year at Rutland Public Library, is starting an effort to clean up the grounds of invasive plants such as bittersweet and spruce up the pollinator garden. So often projects such as that are built for fanfare, and then maintenance becomes an issue. So our Ware River Nature Club group is going to give cleanup upkeep a shot. Check out their website and volunteer some ideas. Next up, Hope Lives Here is Blooming by Danielle Ray, Rutland. The Hope Lives Here Community Memorial Garden, nestled behind the Rutland Free Public Library, continues to grow and flourish thanks to support from many in the area. We have had such an incredible response from our members and the community, Hope's Here Board of Directors member Sherry Rove said of the beautiful space, which was created last year. Quote, "We have so many people who continually come by to help us water the garden, who drop off plants, who come and weed just on their own time. It's pretty incredible to meet strangers every time I go there who become friends, who help us out." Hope Lives Here is a nonprofit organization that was created to help people struggling with loss. Its mission is to be a place of comfort, striving to help people make connections with others who are also struggling with loss by providing support in the form of outreach, one-on-one peer-to-peer support, and support groups. Rofe walked into her first Hope Lives Here meeting in April 2018, nearly 5 years after losing her 18-month-old son, Bennett, and soon after she moved to town with her three other children. She had seen a social media post of Patty Inwood introducing the first meeting of the organization Inwood started after losing her own son Luke to suicide. So Roth decided to go and has been involved ever since. Quote, "The garden is important to me personally because grief and gardening for me went hand in hand," she said recently. "When I lost my son in 2013, it was very hard to know what to do with those empty arms. We were living in Worcester at the time, and I decided it was time to try my hand at gardening. We did a vegetable garden in the corner of my yard. There's something very healing about digging in the dirt and keeping your hands busy while you are grieving." At a board meeting, the idea of a community memorial garden came up. Quote, "We were talking about what the next steps for fundraising looked like for Hope Lives Here," Rofe recalled. "It had always been a goal for us to have an outdoor space for our members, and the idea for our garden came quite organically. To meet both our fundraising and our member goals, it allowed us to get back into Rutland, where we first started meeting, and gives us the opportunity to provide a space for the grief community as a whole. The group is always looking for volunteers to help with weeding, watering, and a little TLC to keep the main street space blooming for everyone who needs it. No experience is needed, just 10 to 15 hours of your time and a willingness to get your hands a little dirty." Quote, "When we started the garden last year, we were lucky enough to have Sarah Clark volunteer as our garden coordinator," Rolf said. "She has since joined the board and become an amazing asset to Hope Lives Here. She's our little garden fairy. She puts out the request for volunteers to water and weed and build planters, etc. Sign-ups for that can be found by visiting their website, which is too long to read during this broadcast, so I would recommend going onto Google and searching Hope Lives Here. Sign-ups. Another way to make an impact is by purchasing an engraved brick to be featured in the garden, a great way to commemorate a loved one who has passed. The bricks will be added to the memorial garden in various spots. There are already about 50 there and 20 more waiting to be ordered. Quote, "We have to order them in bulk, and once we have enough, we have someone on deck who is planning to lay the brick into a patio," Rolf said, who added that the order can be found on the Hope Lives Here website, hlhgrief.org, along with information on all their support groups, programs, and events. Quote, "I would love to highlight our loss of a pregnancy, infant, or child group," Rolf said. "The group will be meeting virtually every second Thursday of the month, and all the information for that group is on our website and social media." With the loss of the Tears Foundation local group, there's not a lot of offered in the area for moms dealing with miscarriage, stillbirth, SIDs. We hope that we can fill that gap. At their most recent annual Hope Lives Here walk to remember, they added a table and seating area to the community gardens, as well as a rainbow bridge to honor pet loss in the community. "We hope to expand the garden with additional beds, benching, and possibly a pergola," Rolf said. "We are also open to feedback from the community and what they would like to see." The group meets on every third Tuesday of the month for the loss of a partner, the fourth Tuesday of each month for the loss of a loved one. The second Thursday of each month is the loss of a pregnancy, infant, young child. And the third Thursday of each month is the loss of a child. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Mo Ryan. Thank you for listening.